Welcome to People More Interesting Than Me, the podcast, where I step back and let fascinating individuals take the spotlight. Join me as I sit down with incredible guests who captivate and inspire, showcasing their stories, experiences, and wisdom that make them truly extraordinary. Tune in for engaging conversations that'll leave you enlightened and entertained. I mean, at least I'm entertained. Our guest this week is none other than Aaron McNaught, a fourth generation Welsh sheepdog farmer. At the age of 16, Aaron was the first woman to win BBC's series One Man and His Dog, a sheepdog competition where shepherds from England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland compete against one another. We'll explore the intricacies of sheepdog training, a craft that requires patience, skill, and a strong understanding of the animals. Moreover, Aaron will shed light on the challenges and triumphs of running a fourth-generation farm in today's fast-paced world. Enjoy. So the first one is, when you were growing up, everyone has like that go-to meal that they eat when they've got like 15 minutes and they just need to eat something?
Okay, dokes. So if I had to choose one meal, it's called lobscaus, which is basically like in Welsh, but it means like a stew. So then we'd always have like a stew cooking, and it would like include Welsh lamb and a lot of vegetables. So then if I wanted a quick meal, I would go and have a bowl full of that stew and probably a piece of bread with it. But it just reminds me of home. It's just like that traditional Welsh meal. But like, yeah, there's always one cooking.
That's awesome. And that's what I imagine that's like, is potatoes or leftover stuff. So you throw it in the stew.
And my nine is a term for grandmother in Welsh. She makes a brilliant stew, and there's always one cooking. And like, say if we've got a busy day on the farm, we'll put one in a thermoflask and take it out with us. So it's just a really versatile thing to have always on the go.
That's awesome. And it has lamb in it. That's even better. Like,
yeah,
over
and,
in the state,
usually lamb that we've produced as well. So that's even better for us.
That's awesome. Over in the States, lamb is kind of like people don't offer it everywhere, like a niche type thing.
But being a sheep farmer myself, and we've also got cattle as well, so I'm a beef and sheep farmer. I have to eat my own produce, isn't it? Because I put so much effort into raising them. I know exactly where they've been grazing, and it's just then a pleasure then to be eating quality meats that I've produced myself.
Do you have guilt ever if you have leftovers of that and like, oh, this was from Millie, and Millie was such like a good like listener and all this stuff, like do you feel guilt if you don't like eat Millie?
Well, we don't call them names. I think that's the most important thing.
That
even though I
sense.
Have got one sheep, which she is a favorite of mine, but she's a breeding ewe, so she's breeding me lambs each year. So in our household, nothing goes to waste because we know how expensive the meat is, and we also know how much effort we've put into producing it. So it would be a shame to see it go to waste. So that's why lobscaus or our stew comes in handy, because you can chuck everything in and have it to eat throughout the week.
No, that's awesome. And thank you for putting in those Welsh words. I think they're just like, they're awesome. I've never really listened to like Welsh. I probably have, and I didn't realize it. And it just sounds so, it's like cursive for words, in my opinion. It's like a really good language.
Yeah, well, I'm first language Welsh. So day to day, it's Welsh I would speak. My mum's a school teacher in our secondary school, so all my education has been through Welsh. It's quite bizarre sometimes speaking English, because it's something I don't speak very often.
Well, you speak it well. Well, no. I'll let you know. So let's dig into the background. What made you get into sheep farming?
So I'm the fourth generation now to be farming, to be keeping sheep and cattle, and also we've got sheep dogs which herd all the animals. So I'm the fourth generation. So it's something you could say that's in the blood. You know, it's something that's just been passed down from generations to generations, which is, you know, as a little girl, I joke that I didn't have much choice because as a little girl, my mum said that I was an awful sleeper. So she would push me out in the pram to the middle of the field and just dump me there while she would be training her dogs. And then, you know, the sheep and the sheep dogs would be going around the pram. And from then on, you know, I was just fascinated by it. So being grown up with it. And then when I became about 15, and I really took an interest in the farm, and I was farming, then I had to have a good sheepdog. So that's when, you know, the passion then for sheepdogs developed, because to be able to do the work on the farm, I needed a good dog to be able to herd them all in. So you could say that it's in the blood, but also, you know, it's in the soil of the farm as well. It's in the history of the place. The first ever sheepdog trial. So that's like a competition where shepherds will go and herd the sheep in with their dogs and then have to go around like obstacles. That's the best way to describe it, really. Go like around an obstacle course with the sheep and the dogs. And then, yeah, the best one wins. So the first ever competition was held on the hillside by our farm in 1873. So there's a deep, history in the farm. So I often joke it's also in the soil as well. So between having it in the blood and in the soil, I don't think I had much choice.
No, makes complete sense. You had sent me the article. You were recently a competitor on the show, right? For BBC, where usually it's obviously a man, and there is it always sheepdog or is it just dog in general?
It's usually a border collie because those are the best for gathering or herding sheep.
Because they're also supposed to be the smartest dog breed, correct?
Yeah,
At
they're
least that's
very
what I've heard.
intelligent, and very loyal as well.
Okay. Because in the States, there's, and I know no details besides this, in the States during Thanksgiving, there's a dog show that usually, I mean, it's not to the same extent as this competition, I would imagine, but they do like a course, they go through like all this stuff. And I would imagine it's a fraction of the skill that the border collies had would have to go through just in, strength and endurance and stuff like that. So how was, I guess, that competition going against tradition? Because you were the first female to, were you the first female to compete too, or no?
No, to win, I believe, or
Okay.
yeah, something along those lines. As I said, the history from here, you know, it's amazing how a kind of hobby or, you know, sheepdog trialing was first. Well, the history was that two shepherds were kind of talking to each other. One was from Scotland and one was from Wales, and they were fighting over who had the best dogs. So, you know, that's how it originated, because they thought, well, we use our dogs every day on the farm. So then the only way we can kind of decide which country has the best dogs is through competing in what we now call a sheepdog trial. So it's amazing how that kind of competition started here on the farm, and then kind of grown worldwide, as we kind of mentioned. And then so the one man and his dog competition, which was on the BBC, that it was kind of like a mimic of like the original competition, like where we had where the way all the countries would be competing against each other, and then the best country wins in that sense. A lot of people often say, oh, it's one man and his dog, and the name needs to be changed, which is true. But, you know, I've grown up kind of, it's always been a male-dominated sport. My mum was one of the first women to compete, probably in her early days, and she had a tough time. But then when it kind of got to me competing, it was a bit more accepted, maybe. But still, you know, women still hadn't kind of reached the top levels and were able to win major trials. So then, yeah, winning the woman and his dog competition was quite was quite an achievement, really. And yeah, kind of hopefully been kind of like flying the flag, really, for women in both farming and also sheepdog competing.
Did you, I assume you've had one of those moments when a little girl comes up to you and is like, I want to be just like you when I grow up. Have you had those moments?
Yeah, you know, I think as well through social media as well, that's also played a part in kind of sharing my story. But it's great, you know, because there's no, to be honest, I think even women are even better at competing and training dogs because we have the patience, you know, and maybe it is something, you know, that anybody could do, really. And I don't think it was fair to be able to call it a male-dominated sport where, you know, there's females are just as capable of running dogs and competing with dogs.
Yeah, of course. So if you could enlighten listeners and tell us, like, what is your normal, not sheepdog day, but more like farm day? Like, what does it look like? And try to go through the times, like...
Oh, gosh. It's, you know, one thing about farming, which I kind of, why I chose it as a career was, you know, because it just varies so much. No day is the same. But the best way probably to describe it is through the seasons. So we've got the kind of the main seasons. So we've got lambing time coming up now. So that'll be spring. So that's when the lambs are born. And probably lambing time is the most hectic time of year for a farmer. It's very, very busy. Then you've got shearing time, which is in the summer, where, you know, most of our days are spent shearing sheep, which is where we take the wool off, because, yeah, the sheep, it gets too hot in the summer for the sheep to have the wool on their backs. And then you've got kind of September time, like autumn, where it'll be mating time. So then the rams will be going out to the sheep, etc. And then we've got the winter then, which we, you know, take out feed for the sheep because grass is deficient. So that was kind of like a run through of the year. But for like from my daily routine, regardless of the season, you know, I wake up and the first thing is I go and see my dogs. So they sleep in the kennels by the house. So I go and open the kennels up and let each dog out to play for a bit and have a stretch. And then I pick which dogs I want to take with me for the day, and then they come with me. And then I go then to see the cattle. So we've got cattle in the shed during the winter. And in the summer, they're obviously out grazing. But when they're in the shed, in the winter, there's like work feeding. So I had to put the silage out. So the silage is what they eat. So I often have a few, like two dogs with me on the tractor, pushing the silage out and making sure the cattle are fed. And then, you know, it's going, I'd spend my days then going around sheep, checking that, you know, walking the fields, checking that each animal is okay. So that's kind of, yeah, a run through. But as I say, it varies and each day is the same. But those are the kind of constants of the day, is making sure the dogs are okay and also making sure all animals are fed and watered and there's nothing in trouble.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I would assume it's more like a oiled machine that, like, obviously the gate on the... I'm going to sound stupid, so just be prepared. The gate on the back end needs to be repaired, or like we've got like, because one of the big things I guess people don't realize is it's not just the dogs are bringing them in. It's like that they're pushing them out. Is that right?
Yeah, so we're lucky in the UK, we haven't got any predators, so the dogs don't have to guard the sheep or anything, but we use the dogs to gather the sheep or to push them or take them to different fields. So we've got like quite mountainous land. I'm farming in North Wales, which, yeah, mountainous land, very rugged. So yeah, we can't use any quad bikes or any machinery on the land because, yeah, it would just be unsafe. So the dogs have to basically do the work. They have to gather the sheep in and then I walk behind and then we take the sheep to different fields to be grazed or to have, you know, to have their food, which is grass predominantly. So that's kind of the work we do. But then when we want to get the sheep into the pens, so the pens is like a collecting yard, so where we would do all the like health work. So if if we needed to do their feet or if we needed to give them their medicine, we'd collect them all into a pen with the dogs, and then we'd be able to handle them easier then. So yeah, the dogs, yeah, they have a very important role on the farm. So yeah, they're unreplaceable really, and I don't think any machine or anything else would be able to replace them.
That was going to be, it was in the back of my head. I mean, obviously you see today, like what drones are doing,
yeah.
And we're at that level of technology. And I was just, you know, like what I would think is like someone has tried to fashion a drone that kind of would careen like mm-hmm. the sheep in. Have you seen anything like that or anything like that pop up?
Yeah. It has been done. I think they call it the barking dog or something, because they've done the drone to bark, so then the sheep hear the drone and they move. But realistically, I don't see farmers taking up that technology, because as a hill farmer myself, you know, I know how important the dogs are, and they're not just, yeah, we use them for work, but they're also companions as well, because life on the farm can be very lonely, especially during busy times like lambing time, where the lambs are born, and I often go without seeing anybody throughout the day. So having a dog by my side is something truly magical, and I'm very grateful for. So I think if you do speak to another hill farmer, I think they would say the same, that, you know, they would never replace the dogs with a drone or anything like that. And it's, you know, a part of our history. It's you know, I think it's my outfit. I always have a dog by my side. Do you know what I mean? It's like something it'd be like losing an arm.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And when we were talking about it, obviously there's those drones or those quadcopters, but then there's a company in the U.S. called Boston Dynamics, I think. And you've probably seen, they're like, you know, the robotic dog that can like jump around or run or do anything. Like, I think they did a spoof on Black Mirror, if you've ever seen that show, mm-hmm. where it's like a robotic dog that has kind of like the, I wouldn't say agility, but, you know, like has the joints and that can actually run as fast. And it's just like, that just seems so inorganic to such a like wholesome and like loving profession. Mm-hmm. Like whenever you think of, or I think of sheepdog farming, I think of legacy, I think of warmth. I feel like there's a strong connection between the people working versus size versus technology. If sheepdog farming has changed, like within 50 years, let's say.
Yeah, that's quite a difficult question, because I think the fundamental values of, you know, dogs haven't changed. They're still, you know, shepherds have been using them for thousands of years to be gathering the fields and to be doing work. But I think there has been, yeah, over the years, competing has come a big thing. So, you know, the dogs would be used on the farm day to day, but then on the weekends, you know, we'd go and compete. So that's kind of like, you know, where we'd go and show off our dogs. And kind of dogs have kind of been developed, well, have been bred then to suit more of the competing side. Well, it's quite difficult to describe, but basically when a competition, you have a field and the dog has to be very, very careful how it moves, because you haven't really got much space. You know, when you have to take sheep through obstacle courses, you know, you have to be so precise and the dog has to work so, so precise. It was kind of against the nature of the kind of farm dogs, because the farm dogs were kind of built for both dogs, although both types need stamina, but farm dogs were maybe a bit more rough and ready. You know, they were used to kind of, pushing big mobs of sheep in. Whereas in a competition, you'd only have four sheep. So, you know, the kind of the types of dog has changed. So dogs have maybe been bred now to be more kind of to become not soft, but yeah, a bit more careful. The types have kind of changed. So it's kind of hard to find a dog that can do both, can both work on the farm and also compete. But I think, you know, hopefully our dogs here on our farm, you know, they are they are quite capable of competing and also doing the farm work. But it's just finding the perfect dog, really, to do both. But yeah, that's kind of the biggest change. They've kind of changed to how they work.
Okay. And yeah, obviously we were talking about border collies. Is there like another breed that tries to get worked in it, like in the recent years, or no?
Yeah, so the Hunterways or the Kelpies have, you know, have come over from New Zealand, and they've kind of become popular with some farmers, because they're a kind of more powerful dog. They can move, they use their voice, they bark, and they can move big mobs of sheep. But then I think, you know, you can't beat the Border Collie because she, or you know, it has the brains, which maybe the Hunterways or the Kelpies don't have quite that same kind of. Yeah, kind of intelligent, maybe. I might be a bit controversial there. But still, you know, I think farmers have, yeah, there's a place for them both. But in a competition, it's definitely the Border Collies that were used, because they're the most intelligent. They listen well, and they just have a way of working the sheep, where the sheep kind of are relaxed. They don't, you know, they don't run, they don't bolt. They just kind of happily trot around the field and going through the obstacle courses.
I was just curious about that, because just like with competition, like there's always a new aspect that springs up. And just like you said, you hear it with horse racing, you hear it with like anywhere where you're trying to make like the fastest greyhound, the fastest horse, the fastest, you know, even with today's like vegetables, you know, that like somebody told me that lemons are actually not their own fruit, that they were just or like citruses that kept on getting bred and bred and bred, the like the most sour citruses, and then they became lemons. Just try to keep on improving.
Yeah, the price that people will pay for those top breeding lines. You know, like I know a Border Collie has hit the record kind of this year, about I think it's £29,000, you know, which is incredible for us. But it just kind of shows the appreciation for the breed as well. You know, obviously people are wanting sheepdogs and that they're willing to pay that much to have the best, which is great. I think it is great for the Border Collie breed. But yeah, still, it's good to make it accessible for everybody to be able to buy a Border Collie and, you know, train and keep in the kind of training and competing side as well. So both sides.
What's the range usually? Like, I know that's a loaded question because there's so many details that go into that. But let's just say to get a pup, and I know that's a range because does lineage go a lot into that? Like, obviously, if you're getting a show dog who's, and I say show dog, I don't mean show dog. I apologize. Like a dog that won the competition, obviously, yeah, you're going to play high end. And I assume that's where the record came from as well, is like this dog's parents were like winners. But keep going.
No, no. So yeah, you know, the pedigrees is important. You know, we map it all out and see who's the grandfather, who's the father, and whatever. And yeah, people will pay a price for that breeding line. So kind of pups, I'd say from the top breeding lines, will be going for about £800 as a pup. So that'll be a six-week-old pup that hadn't been, you know, it's just a pup. Then if you're wanting to buy kind of a partly trained dog, you're looking at maybe £3,000. So that would be kind of a dog that somebody has started to train, like knows its basic kind of commands, but obviously need further work. And then if you're looking to buy like a fully trained dog, you know, you could be looking 6,000 onwards, which, you know, I don't know, it depends who you talk to. It for some people, you know, if you speak to the horse racing people or whatever, you know, it probably sounds like little money to them, but in terms of for our kind of industry or the sheepdog industry, you know, it is big money, because, you know, before, or if I speak to my grandfather, he remembers them going for like £50, but it's great, you know, that, yeah, that people value the sheepdogs, you know, it's I know price isn't everything, but it just shows how much they're valued. And if you had to pay somebody to train a dog, and if you had to pay them per hour, you would, you know, the cost of the dog would sound cheap because so much hours have to be put in to the dog to get it up to standard. You know, you really have to appreciate a trained dog, and the price reflects that as well.
No, that makes sense. And then you might not know the answer, but that record price, did that sheepdog actually get raised up and compete in the competition, or were they just some? Okay, I was going to ask if they were just like some rich person just buying, you know, this dog and being like, oh, they're just, you know, like laying around the house, and they were just bought for, you know, like somebody.
No,
rich.
They're all you know, border collies. They're bred to work, and I think it'd be unfair, really, if you bought a highly bred dog that was obviously, you know, competing lines, it would be unfair not to give it work in a sense. So yeah, it's usually bought by competing people who compete, but also a lot of dogs from here have been exported. A lot have gone to America, you know, loads of countries around the world, because obviously farmers or people in other countries wanted what we had. And, you know, some say that we've kind of lost our best dogs because they've been exported because, other countries kind of pay even a higher price for the dogs as well.
So you mentioned earlier about if there was any like predators or stuff like that. Have you ever had any encounter with like wolves or any? Okay. Oh.
Nope. No, we're nothing scary here in Wales.
Yeah, I was curious. I was like, that would be like the most cliche thing ever to run into a wolf. And
no, the only thing we have here in terms of like that is a danger to sheep is probably foxes. So foxes, you know, they tend to kill young lambs. But there's not much you can do about that, to be honest, really. We don't, you know, we haven't got any guard dogs or anything. We just, you know, have to be walking around the fields checking that everything's okay, really. That's the only way to stop it.
And their sizes are, because when I think of a fox, I think of something maybe like a foot off the ground. I guess the lambs are smaller in size than the fox.
Yeah, so the lambs will be like newborn lambs. So,
understood.
You know, and they mostly kind of kill like the vulnerable ones. So, you know, ones that haven't, ones that are quite not as strong. So that's why it's my job then to be walking around the fields, making sure that every newborn lamb is up on its feet and with its mother, and that will become strong so that it hasn't got a chance of being killed by a fox. But
that makes sense.
That's the only predator in a sense here in Wales.
No, that's good. I mean, is it like that, you know, in other areas with like Ireland or the UK or anything like that?
It's
still
the same story, really.
Okay.
Foxes are the only predators, really.
I would imagine that, like, nowadays, obviously, like, people, I know in the US, like, wolves was a big thing at one point in the national park, and they were just like, you know, they were hunted down, and then there was a huge protection of the wolves, and now they're like running wild, and it's just funny. It's just like give and take, push and pull, like, oh, now we have to correct the population because like they're destroying the whole ecosystem.
So it's the same has happened here, but with badgers. So badgers have been protected, but from a farmer's point of view, badgers carry a disease called TB, and then the cattle can get TB from the badgers. And for us, like, they have devastating effects. If you have TB, you have to shoot the cattle that's affected. You know, there's been a big push in the farming community recently about doing something about TB. Unfortunately, you know, the badger population and, you know, others carry it as well, but, you know, it's kind of gone out of control, and then it's kind of had multiple effects. But it's all about keeping, the ecosystem in balance. You know, kind of let nature do its toll kind of thing.
Yeah. It's crazy how, like, one little thing like that can just get out of control. And then by the time it's a problem, like, much larger steps that have ever been taken need to be taken. Yeah. Is there any memories that really stand out on the farm? Obviously, you said your mom, you followed in her steps and she followed in her family's steps. Mm-hmm. Is there any big milestones that kind of like that hit you hard that you always remember with that?
Yeah, so the fourth generation. So it was my grandfather who owns the farm now. And then my mum had an interest in farming, but then decided to go elsewhere to work. So she's a secondary teacher. So then the farm now has fallen onto me. So that's kind of how it's worked. So I remember as a little girl going with my grandfather, because he was the one that was farming every day. And I remember going to like livestock markets. So there is where we'd sell the livestock. And I just remembered, being the only girl, only, a little girl in the amongst of all these scary farmers, which aren't that scary, but I suppose for somebody young. And, the proudest moment for me was when my grandfather would let me go into the ring where we would sell our livestock and stand there selling our livestock kind of thing. And, seeing everybody bid for them. That was kind of, a really proud moment for me. But then the kind of probably the biggest milestone is when I took over the farm when I was 18. So I finished school and my grandfather fell very ill. So then at that point, I kind of knew I had to either kind of sell the farm or that I come home and farm it. So that was kind of the big milestone and the big decision to be made. And of course, with being grown up on a farm, I knew what my decision was. And that's kind of when I decided to take the responsibility of the farm and carry on farming. So that was kind of the big decision.
That's a huge decision at 18, because it was a big decision. Was there any other options or thoughts like besides taking on the farm?
Yeah, I'd done my A levels. So I was kind of prepared to go to university and I had done really well. I had 3 A stars. So I was, everybody was pushing me to go to university. But I knew deep down that it wasn't for me. I knew that I wanted to take this opportunity to come home and farm, because I'd always regret if I hadn't. It was hard. It was a hard decision. But I have kind of, I've been farming now for 4 years. And I have done a degree. Well, I'm in my second year of doing a degree, but I'm doing it from home. So it's working really well. I'm still running the business, but I'm also, kind of doing further personal development through doing my degree. And I'm doing it in geography and environmental science. So it actually does tie in a lot to farming issues. And it's really interesting, really. But just for personal development, really. Just so I've got a degree to my name. But obviously, my heart is in the farm. Yeah.
No, that's awesome. And you said that you've had it for 4 generations. When did that, hit me with that number? That's going to surprise me. How long has it been in the family? Sorry, and a year. I'm sorry.
So in terms of how many years, I'm not sure, to be honest.
See, that's how old it is. You have no idea.
It's easy just to say four generations, because I haven't really done the maths. but still, I knew it was something that's very important for the family. And even, I've got a brother and sister, and they've got an interest in farming, but they're wanting to have careers elsewhere, but still they kind of feel that it's important to keep the family farm going. So they're very supportive of me, making sure that it is running day to day. Because family farms are something that's becoming very scarce. Farming is going, a lot of farms are growing bigger and bigger and becoming big corporations. But we're kind of lucky here in North Wales. We're hill farms, and they're run by families, because families know the land best. It's important for me to keep that tradition going. And I do hope one day when I have a family that it'll be able to be passed on as well.
That was going to be my follow up question. Would you go about the same way with your kids? That
to be brutally honest, it's not a lot of money in it. You know, you're kind of driven for the love, really. But, you know, I think having the skills of being grown, you know, if you, for children growing up on a farm is amazing. You know, you've always, from a year early stage, you've been taught to work hard, you know, to, you've always got the animals, you've grown a respect for the animals. You've got skills like driving skills. You know, we'd be driving, you know, farm trucks when we were too young, probably, but it's a skill, you know, it's a skill to have. And when it came to passing our driving tests, I think we all passed first time, and you know, it's a skill to have. And also skills, you know, in terms of paperwork as well. There's a lot of paperwork in farming, and it's a business at the end of the day. So as young children, you know, we've been kind of taught that it's a business. So there's all sorts of skills to be had from growing up on a farm. And even though, you know, if my children don't want to farm, but I think it's still important that they have those experiences and have those skills. And then they can apply those skills to whatever jobs they want to do. But I think, you know, the farming bug is something, you know, that it's something that inevitably, if you're grown up on a farm, you know, I think you'll appreciate. I do hope one day we pass to the next generation. Yeah.
No, that's great. So speaking on skills, would you say that there's any, obviously with technology growing and people expanding, is there any like new skills that you've had to take on within a changing environment?
Yeah, so it's always important to be up to date with the new technologies and to learn, yeah, about the updates in the industry. And I have been doing a lot of work on the political side as well. So I do a lot with the National Farmers Union, lobbying MPs and doing, you know, that kind of political side, which is a change to being in my wellies and to be in some nice clothes. It is a dynamic industry and it's an exciting industry. And, you know, I had to kind of really get my head around the business elements, you know, because it's a business at the end of the day. I know, you know, we farm because we love it and, you know, all of that. But at the end of the day, we have to make it a profitable business as well, or we won't be here. So, yeah, the main skills probably was the business skills, being able to do my cash flows, the profit and loss sheets, and, yeah, being clued up with that, really. And I think, you know, what's kind of important to me is to showcase that farming is a good career path. You know, because when I was kind of in school, farming was for the boys who, you know, wanted that. Maybe we weren't into schoolwork. But it is the opposite. To be a farmer, you have to have those skills. You have to be able to be intellectual. You have to be able to do your maths. And, you know, it's an important skill. And it's an important industry to have, because at the end of the day, everybody needs a farmer. You know, we have to be producing food, or else we'll have no human population. So it's an important role to have, and I just wish, you know, that it's more appreciated within general public, and that, you know, if in 20 years' time, my daughter or my son told me, "Oh, I want to be a farmer," then, you know, I'd clap my hands, say yes, go for it, and not, you know, be like, "Oh, like maybe that's not the career." You know, it's like you could do better in a sense, yeah.
Yeah, that makes complete sense when you're saying, obviously, the business side, because when you were telling me about, like, when you turned 18, you decided, because I don't know at what point when I was looking around here, because, I mean, like you said, a lot of farms could get bought up by big corporations, but that's such a, like, a large, like, when you would sell it, it would be for, like, a large sum, but then at that point, you're selling something that's, like the crown jewel of the family. Like you said, you don't even know when you got the property. Like, it could be like in times when obviously there's no electricity, it's just unfathomable to sell it.
Yeah, and I know myself though, if one of my children wanted to farm or whatever, and they didn't have a farm, it'd be a job to buy a farm. So, you know, that's why, you know, it's important to kind of keep it going. But yeah, there's always other options for people who haven't got a farm themselves. You know, there are other options of getting into the industry, but it is difficult, I must say. And having a farm to come home to, you know, has helped me tremendously. And I just, yeah, I think it is important to keep it in the family, because once it's gone, you can't replace it.
Yeah. Because I mean, the other thing is that you were talking about the business side is like you have to work at it. I would imagine like you can't just like it's not gonna sustain itself. Like there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. And if you're not making that margin, you're not gonna be able to, you know, like afford like all the feed for all the animals, all the straw. And like all the, like, I would imagine heaters are expensive, especially in the winter for the sheep. You got to, well, is that true? Like heating is a big expense.
Yeah, we're lucky we don't get such cold weather, but when the lambs are born, we make sure that they are warm and we've got lamps up to keep them warm. But yeah, you know, and I think what's the most difficult part of farming is that we're affected by so many external factors. It's a minefield really, and you can be quite down about it when you have to list all the things that can affect your business. You can take a sheep or a cow to a market and you don't know what price you're gonna get. You just have to take what you get, which can be very difficult. And I think that's like the most difficult part of farming is all the things that affect the business and that you have no control of. That is difficult. And, you know, I kind of know myself, even though we are kind of a medium-sized farm for the area, we're about 350 acres. I know myself, if I want, you know, that I will have to go out and work elsewhere if I wanted to keep a family. And it's a sad reality for many farmers. They're having to do two jobs. They're having to, kill them. Well, you know, work so hard on the farm and, you know, and then having to go and get some extra income as well elsewhere. It's a sad reality. And I hope that will change one day. I hope, you know, food and the importance of farmers will, you know, will change and there'll be more appreciation and farmers will be valued more. But at the moment, the sad reality is, you know, that farming, to make it a profitable business, that we need to either diversify. So I've been looking at ways to diversify the business or go and work elsewhere. That's the sad reality, really.
Yeah. And when you were mentioning, like, listing all the issues, like you spoke earlier, I would never have put badgers on the list. I think that's like what where badgers is like a problem. That's crazy.
There's so many. And at the moment, you know, in Wales here, we're going through, big changes in the government. And there's a lot of things that are kind of affecting us. There's a big push to plant trees, which, you know, have their place in the climate change world. But through planting trees, we're losing valuable land. We're lucky here in Wales, we can be producing climate friendly food because all our livestock is produced primarily off grass and we have plenty of rain. So grass is, we've got loads of grass. So we can be producing climate friendly food. But if our land was to be planted with trees, well, we couldn't do that any longer. And once the land is planted, then it's gone forever. So that's kind of a sad reality, another sad reality we're facing as well, because obviously we're being pushed by the government to plant, which will, you know, it's going to have a detrimental effect on family farms like ours.
Yeah, makes complete sense. You talked about how hard it is to get into farming, especially if it's not a generational thing. What would you tell someone, obviously, outside of that realm, if they're interested in kind of getting into sheepdog training or we'll just say sheepdog training, like, I don't know, a farm aspect?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think that, you know, you have to have that passion. So if you kind of, if you do really want to do something, you know, that you will obviously achieve it. And it's just a matter of kind of, getting in contact with people, you know, like myself. I offer training courses where people come and train. I train them to train the dog. You know, get in touch with people and really kind of take advantage of those training opportunities. And, you know, through meeting people and getting different connections, you'll suddenly find, you know, that you're in a good place to be able to be competing. But I know a lot of comp- competitors, they're not necessarily from a farming background. They haven't got a farm themselves, but they keep sheepdogs, and then they get to, you know, borrow some sheep or borrow a field from a farmer and get to train like that. So there's different ways, you know, if you really want to do something, you'll find a way of making it work. You really will. But I think, you know, it's just, and, you know, to be kind of finishing maybe on a more positive note, as I have been kind of, yeah, going through, I have been saying some of the challenges we're facing, but still, I think it's important to keep positive, be optimistic. And, you know, it's a great industry to be in. It's a dynamic industry. It's changing. But you just have to kind of keep up with the times. Yeah.
Oh, that's a great answer. Especially, I mean, I didn't think you were disheartening on it at all. I just, it felt refreshing. It felt like a passion the way you're talking about it.
It's difficult because, yeah, there's a lot, you know, farming, we've got some farmers in Europe that are protesting. We're not protesting here in Wales yet. But, you know, there is a kind of that really bad negative talk around farming and the agricultural industry, which I find really, really sad. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we're producing food for the population, and everybody needs food, regardless of what it might be. It might be vegetables, it might be meat, whatever. And I just, yeah, for the young generation, I think it can be disheartening, and it can put people off from being a farmer or from, you know, training sheepdogs or whatever. So I think it is important to kind of be optimistic and to kind of share the good stuff as well. But, you know, obviously, you know, realizing the issues, but also to end on a positive note. Yeah.
Yeah. So my last question I end every episode with is, what is something that your parents did, maybe a tradition, maybe an ideal that you'd like to pass on to a next generation? And what is something new or different that you would do?
So in terms of passing on that what my parents did, I think they really pushed me. And, you know, in Wales, we've got a big kind of culture of singing and dancing and performing. We've got something that's called the Eisteddfod, where it's like a big competition for kids in Wales to be, yeah, doing all sorts, from dancing, reciting, singing, all sorts. And they really did push me to get involved in that. And they really did push me to be involved in the Young Farmers Club as well. And, you know, that's kind of a similar thing. We obviously talk about farming, but we also do a lot of we do a lot of concerts and singing, and, you know, it's a big part of what we do. And I think having those experiences and having those skills is something I'll always be grateful for. It's something that, you know, you really feel a part of the community. It's a community spirit. And, you know, it ties on nicely to agriculture in a sense, even if you wouldn't think so. But, you know, yeah, a lot of our socializing is, you know, done through those sorts of activities. So I'm very, yeah, I think that's important for the next generation to have as well. Something I would do different. Oh, that's a difficult one, probably. I think probably I would. That is a difficult. I think, you know, obviously I would love my children to grow up in a farm, and my parents were very supportive of me coming home to farm. But in general, the general feeling, as I mentioned earlier, was, oh, you know, I shouldn't be coming home to farm. You know, it's, yeah, you could be doing things elsewhere. And, you know, people thought I'd spend my days in wellies and in mud, and, you know, never being have these big opportunities. But it's quite the opposite. I've been able to mould my career in agriculture to the way I wanted it to be. So yes, I spend most of my days in wellies and mud and all sorts. But I also, you know, I do go to London. I do, you know, I've met the Prime Minister. I've gone to all sorts of events there. I have spoken in science expeditions, all sorts, you know, and I don't spend my days in wellies all the time. There's so, so much more to my career in agriculture. So I just wish, yeah, what I would say to my children is, you know, that mould it to what you want it to be. Don't necessarily think that, you know, the stereotypical image of a farmer is being in wellies. There's so, so much more. You know, I have friends who work in all sorts, you know, office jobs, but doing agricultural work. You know, there's so many jobs within agriculture. It's not just restricted to working the land and being in mud and wellies all day. That, you know, there's so, so much more. So I would, yeah, encourage my children to explore what the industry has to offer.
That's awesome. That's a good fresh take, because obviously the image of that is like, and I assume wellies, is that the one with the it's kind of like coveralls and they're made of like a like not a rubber but like a
So we've got the wellies are like a rubber boot, and then you've got the overalls as well. Ideal for the mud that we currently have here in Wales, because even though it's good to have the rain, but it can mean that the fields can get quite muddy sometimes. So wellies are definitely an appropriate footwear to wear. But it doesn't have to be wellies. You could, you can shape your career in agriculture and what you want it to be.
No, that's a great answer. By the way, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it, Aaron.
Oh, no problem. No, it's nice to chat.
No, it was great. And is there anything you want to promote while you're on here? Anything you're working on that you'd like to share with listeners?
Not a lot I can share, to be honest. There's some exciting things coming up. But just, kind of a shout out to my social media, really. We didn't really touch on it much, but social media has really been an important tool for me to be able to showcase what we do on farm. And the challenges, but also the good stuff as well. If you have an interest, the account is Erin Pandy Farm on Instagram. And I just try and share what I'm doing, and hopefully it will be of interest to people.
And for people listening, I will tag everything I post with that, and I'll put that in the description for the episode so everyone can find it.
Oh, fab.
Okay, well, I'll let you go. Have a great day.
Thank you. Take care.
See ya.
If you like this week's episode of People More Interesting Than Me, please follow me on Apple Podcasts so you won't miss out on more episodes like these.